Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota Senator Billy Sutton is Democratic Minority Leader in the State Senate. He joins us now on the phone from Pierre for a look at what's happening in the State House from the Democrats' point of view. Senator Sutton, welcome back to In the Moment.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, let's start with some of your legislative priorities personally or as a caucus. Where do you want to begin?
Yeah, sure. We, some of my legislation that I'm proposing is somewhat similar to what the caucus's focuses are, and that's more transparency and accountability in government, and came from a lot of the discussions around, the EB-5 and gear up scandals and those kinds of things. And so a couple of the bills we're working on is kind of an open correspondence bill that would open up emails for state agencies and employees. And so that's one bill that we've put in. And then also I put in a records retention bill. One of the things that we found in the discussion around Gear Up is that the Department of Education was only keeping fiscal records for 5 years, and every department does it a little differently. And so I proposed a bill that creates a more uniform process and just says, you're going to keep fiscal records for at least 10 years at a minimum. And so that is actually in State Affairs. Had the hearing yesterday, and no action was taken yet on that bill. And so we'll see where that goes. Really a focus on accountability and transparency in government. And then also a focus on workforce development and education as it relates to education. I think that's something Governor Dugard is pushing this session as well.
Let's go back to a little bit of the transparency and accountability measures and dig into them a little more deeply. Open correspondence and looking at emails, what are the details of that? How does that work in practice?
Well, I think that right now there's just an exemption, and so there's a presumption that they're not open. And so what this would do is essentially remove that exemption. And so then now there's a presumption that they are open. So if the press or newspapers or somebody wants to request information, they can go through the process of requesting, maybe on a topic or however they would like to make that request. And then at least there is a presumption of openness as it relates to state government emails. I mean, taxpayer dollars are involved, and I think that it's only fair that taxpayers know what's going on in their government.
All state employees?
Yep. It's. I think the bill says employees of any state agency.
Okay. So how does it implement it? So as a journalist, I want to know something. I ask for someone's emails. I ask for a topic, and then it's searched and provided for me. How do you play it out in reality?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to work through that process a little bit. This is something new to South Dakota, and I think we can garner a lot from what other states have done. But I think the first step is that presumption of openness, and then let's work through it, because there still are going to be situations where if there is sensitive information or information that contains social security numbers, right, medical records, things like that are still exempt.
Sure.
So there still are going to be exemptions, and so there's still going to be a process of making sure that we're protecting people's privacy, but yet that we're being open at the same time. So you have to draw kind of a fine line.
Right. I get a lot of emails.
Right. I think we all do.
As everybody looks at their email account, they're like, oh, would that be for lawmakers too then?
The way I read it, it doesn't, I don't think so. I would be open to, as the discussion moves on, I think it was kind of just, we wanted to start somewhere.
Sure.
And as the discussion moves on, I'm certainly open to that conversation. I'm pragmatic about it. I want us to get something done and try to use common sense in doing so. And this would just be a first step, and I think that would be a good first step.
Right.
But the way I read it, no.
Okay, so right now I would be affected, but you wouldn't. People could request my emails, but not yours, because I'm a state employee.
Yes, I mean, I mean,
not that they would.
Right, right. And I've been, I think that if there's a willingness from the legislature to include themselves, I am all for that. At this time, I'm not so sure that's the case.
Right. And you know, we receive, I think a lot of people in the working world receive a lot of training and advice that says, you know, make sure if something is confidential that you treat it in a secure fashion, and make sure if something is sensitive that you treat it in a secure fashion, and be aware that much of what you're dealing with is public, and be as transparent as you can. So we just had training on this as well. Interesting. What kind of conversations are you having about it in peer? How are people responding to it?
I think they're responding really well. I mean, it's a bipartisan bill. I mean, I have a lot of support from members of both sides of the aisle, and that's really important up here. Here to get things done, and so I'm very happy with that. I guess we'll see. You know, when the bill was originally written, we actually talked about it at Government Operations and Audit Committee this summer, and that's when I kind of started the push for this, is because a discussion about emails between the you know, a past Secretary of Education and some members of the Department of Education, and how we didn't feel like we were getting all the emails, and just, you know, that was problematic. It was hard for us to even have a conversation about it. And so, you know, that kind of started a bipartisan discussion.
Is it retroactive then? Can you, you know, if the bill passes, is it something that you can go back 5 years or go back six months?
I don't see why not. You know, I don't see why not. But originally as written, you know, we included all emails, which would have included, you know, cities, you know, city employees, any form of government, you know, county government. And ultimately, we chopped it down quite a bit because, as I said, I mean, sometimes you just have to start somewhere and build from there and have that conversation.
And what kind of conversations are around the records retention? I'm guessing that must be a challenge, a similar challenge with, you know, how exactly do you implement it? Where do you start? Where is the storage? You know, that sort of thing. That seems a little easier to address to me.
Right. Well, I do think that the records retention discussion really has some legs. I mean, I think that's also a bipartisan bill. The problem that we ran into is that when our Department of Legislative Audit went to audit, you know, the Gear Up situation, and they were looking for financial records, they found that, you know, prior to 5 years, there were no records. And Gear Up has been around a lot longer than 5 years. I mean, at that, when the Gear Up situation happened, it'd been around for, I suppose, 10 years, something like that. So that's kind of why we picked the number of records retention of 10 years. Now, I'm not saying that's the magic number, but it's also a starting point. And with technology anymore, we should be able to store things for a long, long, long time.
Campaign finance limitations, that's still on your agenda?
It is, yep. I have a bill on that as well. It basically, I mean, I feel like it's certainly a pretty extensive bill, but it's not complicated to the degree that it's exactly the same limits that I am 22. From the 20, well, that was repealed last year, by the legislature. So it seeks to put those limitations back in, and you know, we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, limitations to what? What do you think is again not a magic number necessarily, but
right. So for instance, prior to the passage of I'm 22, contributions from, you know, political action committees were unlimited. And I'm 22 put a limit on that. It also lowered limits for a lot of, you know, individual contributions, things of that nature. And so what I'm seeking to do is just to say, look, there were, you know, I'm 22 got repealed. There were some moves to replace portions of it. This is one of the portions that was not challenged at all as being constitutional, or, you know, unconstitutional, and it never got replaced. They put together this summer work group, or task force, if you want to call it, on campaign finance that I served on, and we had the discussion, and several of the members of the committee wanted to put this in place, and it got voted down in committee. So we decided that we need to have the discussion again in the legislature. The voters, you know, passed that measure, and I think it was important to try to respect their will.
And this is, does it bring the democracy credit idea back into the conversation, or just puts straight limits on it without public financing?
No public financing, just the straight limits. I think that that's probably as close to a reasonable conversation as we're going to get on that issue is the campaign finance limitations. I'm not sure the legislature is even ready to talk about the democracy credits thing yet. But, you know, I hope we can have a good conversation about this campaign finance issue, because I'm just of the belief that, you know, money in politics, I think you have to have enough money to run a competitive race, and you have to, you know, I think it should be, it's certainly important, but it shouldn't be the only factor. And too often, it's just a money game, and people lose focus on what they're sent here to do and who they're serving.
And did you say what those limitations would be?
There's multiple different sections of those limitations.
All right.
And it's a pretty extensive bill.
What number is it, so we can put a link up on our website and people can kind of go through it line by line?
I believe it's Senate Bill 129.
Okay. So we'll put a link up and folks can go through it line by line. So if they want to learn more, let's move on to workforce development and sort of opportunities there. For you, workforce development is about an economic opportunity. It's tied pretty closely to education, right?
Absolutely. And that's why we were so happy to hear, you know, when the governor talked at his State of the State address, he talked a lot about workforce development and the importance of education in workforce development. And so we hope to partner with him in that discussion. We I've put in several bills relating to that. For instance, one of the bills that I'm actually pretty excited about that seems to be getting some pretty positive feedback is creating a career technical education kind of consortium fund. And what that means is, the best way to explain it, I think, is to give an example. My hometown of Burke partnered with three other schools. They partnered with Colombe, Gregory, and South Central School District. So four schools. A few years ago, they got a grant from the governor's office out of the Future Fund for, I believe it was $800,000, right in that ballpark. And they bought four mobile units. So these mobile CTE classrooms, essentially. And so each school has one of these mobile units. And so each year they rotate, because each unit offers a different course. So one offers welding, one offers manufacturing, one offers engineering, and one offers biomed. And so every kid in high school, in all those schools, has an opportunity at least one year to take each of those courses. And it's really an innovative way for rural schools especially to offer more. I mean, you know, Sioux Falls has its own CTE high school.
Right.
And you have a lot of rural communities that when the cuts happened in 2011, some of the first programs to go were career and tech ed courses. And so we've got to get creative on how we do this. So what this does is it just creates a fund that schools that partner with three or more other schools total can apply for a grant to have help with offering innovative and, you know, collaborative CTE courses.
Is the goal?
And I think that's key.
Yeah. Is there a teacher who goes with each mobile unit, or is that something? Are they like more?
No, that's something
web-based,
that,
or?
No, that's something that the schools are going to have to work out. I mean, that certainly is a challenge, and you know, teachers are in high demand, especially for those courses. But our area, I mean, the consortium that was created with Burke and the three other schools,
right,
provide teachers, and they share teachers.
Okay,
so that one, you know, welding teacher each year will have to go, you know, maybe go to Colom for one school year, mm-hmm. and do a little traveling that way, or go to Bonestell for a school year, or they might be from Bonestell, you know. So there's the sharing and it of the teachers, and so not every school has to have right. you know, all four teachers. They might have one of the teachers for those four.
So is the idea behind this that, you know, a student who, you know, maybe wants to be introduced, you know, or is introduced to welding, for example, that then she or he would be inspired to go on to a technical college? Or is the idea
Correct.
To provide yep. the skills that they need to go straight into the workforce?
I think it could be a little of both, you know, but what I've heard that I really liked is that when I've talked to students that have taken some of these courses, mm-hmm. They've said, you know what, I didn't know that I was interested in this, but now I am, and this, I know what I want to do now.
Right.
So maybe, you know, maybe we saved them a year of college cost because, you know, they now know what they're going to do. Or maybe they decide, you know what, 4 years isn't for me. I'm gonna go to tech school and to be a welder
right.
because I really found a passion for this.
Well, there used to and be the, home economics and industrial arts classes. Maybe I'm revealing mm-hmm. my age there. What did you take in high school? Did you have a shop
they
option?
They had home ec.
They had home ec? Okay,
they had shop. Yeah, we also had shop. So,
yeah.
But there was a time when, you know, they didn't. Right. From when I had graduated to just a few years ago, you know, Burke started doing a home, you know, they built a home a year. And that's been really successful. And then what they do is they'll work with, you know, maybe a local contractor or somebody, and they build the home, and then they sell the home, and now you have an extra home in your community, or it could be, you know, shipped yeah. somewhere else too. And that's an interesting conversation to have when you start talking about, you know,
right.
a housing shortage in our state.
Right.
Because there certainly is one.
I had to sew a pair of shorts, which, I mean, it wasn't just sew a beanbag, okay? It wasn't just, like, make a
right.
pillow. I had to, like,
yep.
sew an actual pair of shorts that fit me and that I could, you know, wear.
There
and
you go.
I did a great job yep. of that.
But what I love about this idea and the concept is that even if kids decide they don't like those things, that's still, to me, a good thing.
Yeah, right.
Because they figured that out earlier. But also, let's say that they're just indifferent. The very worst case scenario, they learned a skill.
Right.
That they will probably use the rest of their life.
Yeah.
At some point.
Yeah. And they learn to value the people who are, I mean, if you learn something and you learn you can't do it, you also learn to value the person who can
exactly.
in some ways.
And they... Yeah, absolutely. And they had the opportunity to, you know, for instance, the manufacturing, to build a home that
yeah.
they can feel like they really accomplished something.
Interesting.
And I think that's worth a lot.
Legislation about giving working people sick leave and helping families with their affordable education. Looking at a press release now from South Dakota Democratic Party. What's that about?
Yeah, there was a bill to provide paid sick leave, I believe. I believe it died in committee.
Okay.
So that one's already been disposed of. What was the second one you mentioned?
It says helping families afford a college education. Again, it's a fairly general press release. I'm just wondering
yep.
what's yep. out there. Yeah.
No, that was, I'm guessing that was in, you know, I don't know, but I'm guessing that was in reference to the needs-based scholarship. Because
okay.
we also have a bill on that. You know, the Board of Regents was really pushing hard before session to talk about the need for increased funding for needs-based scholarships.
Yeah.
We just got recent numbers back that for every Pell Grant eligible student in South Dakota, we offer not quite $12 per student in needs-based funding.
Hmm.
The sad part about that is that I believe Wyoming is at $2,200 per Pell Grant eligible student. Minnesota, I think, is now up to like $1,800 per Pell Grant eligible student.
Hmm.
We are very, very far behind. in our needs-based scholarship. We were the last state to have one, is my understanding. But we have one now. We've had it for a few years. It just has not been funded to the degree it needs to be funded. So we're proposing to use future fund dollars to start funding the needs-based scholarship the way it needs to be. I think the Board of Regents said it needed about $3.3 million over the next 3 or 4 years to get us to a place that they feel comfortable. And I think that's a conversation we need to have. If we want our kids to be competitive and to stay in South Dakota and to build their lives here, we have to create the opportunities for them to do so. And that's what the needs-based scholarship allows, is for kids that don't have the resources to compete right here in South Dakota.
South Dakota Senator Billy Sutton, you've been generous with your time. Thank you so much. We hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much.